Welcome to Walter Edgar's Journal. With me in the Scanner studio today are Professor Ben Franklin from the University of South Carolina, who is the author of an encyclopedia of South Carolina jazz and blues musicians. And we've talked to Ben about his book before, but he's back here because we're going to talk about a Charlestonian, Fud Livingston, who is the great uncle of John Tecklenburg, who is the mayor of Charleston. And so with that introduction, gentlemen, welcome to the Journal. I want to start with you, Mr. Mayor. Tell us a little bit about your kinsman here.
Well, thank you, Walter. It's great to be with you today. My great uncle, Fud Livingston, his real name was Joseph, but he got this nickname, Fud, because his little sister couldn't pronounce my brother, called him my Fudder. Anyway, it was a very musical family of the five children. Four were very gifted musically, including my grandmother, who taught piano lessons for 52 years. And in fact, she was about 11 years older than Fud. And when she started teaching piano lessons back in about 1910, Fud was one of her students. But they lived just two doors down from Marion Square on King Street in Charleston, where the Jenkins Orphanage Band would often play, and it was a musical family. Fud's older brother, Toots, was his nickname. He became a jazz musician professionally in the early 20s, and so Fud followed his footsteps after getting kicked out of the Citadel in 1923, but that's another part of the story.
And didn't he practice with some of the musicians from the Jenkins Orphanage?
Yes, he did, and they would jam together, and even when Fud would return home from New York and Chicago after his career started, he would often go to those haunts and clubs where local musicians would be playing in Charleston. Of course, I think musicians did that everywhere. As I mentioned, he followed his older brother's footsteps, Toots, who was playing already with a Chicago band, the Ted Weems Orchestra, and had a million record seller in 1923, upon which Toots became known as a well-known soloist in the country. So Fud kind of followed his footsteps and ended up in Chicago in a band called the Ben Pollock Orchestra. And Ben was a drummer that used to put together really talented musicians, and he found Fud. Fud was only 18 at the time, already playing any kind of instrument, but mostly reed instruments, but he was a writer and arranger already, which was unusual. So anyway, there was a 17-year-old kid in the band playing trombone, and his name was Glenn Miller. And then there was this kid who was 16 years old, just out of school, who played the clarinet, named Benny Goodman. And so Fud connected with these incredible musicians as a teenager, really at an early age, which embarked him on an incredible career and journey of early jazz in America, including what was the evolution at that time of what we now know as the big band sound. Okay. And as you may know, jazz, even though Charleston was an important cradle of jazz, I believe, particularly because of the Jenkins Orphanage, which we can talk about later, but New Orleans obviously was, and the riverboats brought jazz musicians up to Chicago, yeah, including Louis Armstrong and others. And so Chicago was really the hub of early jazz in the early 20s. But what happened when recording started in earnest, like in the mid to late 20s, most of the talented musicians moved to New York City. And that's where more recording studios were and more of the action was. So Fud moved with many of those other musicians to New York in 1927. He was a writer. He was a studio musician. He was in the studio almost every other day. I've been able to collect literally hundreds of recordings from 1927, 28, and 29 that he was on. And here's the tragic part of the story, that Fud was a terrible alcoholic, and late in his life, it really got the better of him. And so when I was a young boy growing up, I was only 2 years old when Fud passed away. What my family mostly remembered, unfortunately, was the more tragic part of his life, where alcoholism was a real factor. And so I didn't know a lot about Fud growing up. It wasn't until I went to the Berklee College of Music, I was 21 years old, and I'd always heard about this one song that Fudd wrote that was pretty well known, I'm Through With Love, but I really didn't know anything else about his career. And I go to the card or music catalog at Berklee College of Music to see if they had this recording of Uncle Fudd's. And it was there, sure enough, I'm Through With Love. But then I kept flipping under Fudd Livingston. There was Feeling No Pain. There was Imagination. There was Humpty Dumpty. There was song after song and band after band. And I started listening to these incredible recordings from the 1920s. And I just couldn't believe what I had found. It's just amazing.
So did you go to Berklee for research, or did you go there to train as a musician? Because you're a pretty good pianist.
Well, thank you. And yes, I went to train as a musician. I only stayed for a year because I realized, I guess, my talent was such that I'd probably be able to support a family a little better if I were in business or some other profession. But I certainly relish my time there, not only for improving my meager skills, but also to find out about Uncle Fudd. So that started a lifelong quest for me to find his recordings, to find his writings, to interview other musicians who had played with him. And I really got, if I may say, a wonderful collection of his music.
On that topic, I would think that most of his recordings would be available on YouTube. Is that right?
There are a number on YouTube now, I think maybe 40 or 50 that you can find that Fudd recorded on, but I literally have hundreds. There are many that are not on YouTube.
Ben, you've got a very nice entry of Fudd in your wonderful encyclopedia. Have you got a favorite of his?
Yes. I would say a tune he recorded with Fred Elizalde in London called Nobody's Sweetheart. He arranged that tune, and it gets me to my very core. I absolutely love that tune.
It's a beautiful arrangement, and Fudd plays the clarinet solo on it as well, beautifully.
Ben, what's the backstory on that song?
Fred Elizalde was one of the few Philippine jazz musicians ever. He located to England and tried to create a hot jazz scene there. And he had a lot of American musicians in that group, including Adrian Rollini, who was featured there on bass saxophone. And Elizalde decided that he would put on a mammoth jazz concert in London. But to enhance the orchestra, he sent Rollini back to the United States to get some more ace American musicians, one of whom was Fudd Livingston. So Fudd arrived, and Elizalde had this recording session that resulted in the tune we just heard. That was before the concert was to be held, and as the concert approached, suddenly Fudd disappeared. It turns out that Fudd went to Paris on a bender, and after the bender, got on a ship and went back to the United States. So the reason for his being there was not the recording session, but rather to participate in this concert, which he did not do.
He missed the gig.
Okay. One of the things that, John, that you said, he left the Citadel, but it said here he was actually studying composing and arranging at the Citadel. And in 1923, I had no idea that was part of the curriculum at the Military College of South Carolina.
Well, it wasn't formally. He studied music on the side, but if I was amazed when I went by the Citadel one afternoon and got a copy of their 1923 yearbook. He was in the marching band. He was in a small jazz orchestra that they had at the Citadel. These were not formal courses, but he also helped produce a minstrel show that apparently they did every year, and he was the writer and arranger. And in fact, in the 1923 annual of the Citadel, there's a page of music in the annual that's arranged by Fudd Livingston. I thought it was amazing. Fine when I saw that. So he left the Citadel, as I mentioned, and joined this band in Chicago. And after they were together a couple of years, they started recording. And so in 1925, late 1925 and 1926, in Chicago, the Ben Pollock Band was recording. And they brought on a vocalist with the band, a young lady named Hannah Williams. And Fudd fell in love with Hannah. just head over heels and proposed to marry her. And he thought that they were going to get married, but alas, and it's a beautiful song or two that they recorded together. Fudd does an amazing arrangements. But, you know, a year or two later, when Fudd thought that they would be married, she ends up leaving him for another man. And so he was heartbroken. And you thought that, would think maybe that Fudd would have fought over her, but the guy she married was Jack Dempsey.
Well, I just realized in 1923, he was 17 years old. The 17-year-old kid, I guess, gets on a train and goes to Chicago. I mean, I think that's pretty amazing.
Well, I think he was 18 when he got there. But again, he was following the footsteps of his older brother, who was maybe a mature 21 at the time and already playing in a well-known band in Chicago. So he, I'm sure, was a bit under his brother's wing.
Let's look at the broad music scene in the United States, and particularly in Charleston at this time in the early 1920s. And Ben, you want to start off?
There is a racial divide here we need to address, and that is that most of the popular music was created by and was consumed by white people, middle-class whites. And it was within that that we have Fudd Livingston. And I'm not putting this down at all. That's just the reality, that there is a substratum there, which was the blues and blues-influenced music, which was primarily black. And it was with the latter that Charleston, primarily because of the Jenkins Orphanage, made the great contribution to American music. In fact, I was trying to think, other than Fudd and Toots Livingston, what white musicians from South Carolina at large created significantly to the music of the 20s and 30s. And I came up only with the name of Johnny Blowers, who was a drummer from Spartanburg, who played with everybody around that time, especially in the 30s, 40s, and 50s, including Billie Holiday, and he became a somewhat semi-regular drummer with Frank Sinatra, for example. But other than that, and maybe a few minor exceptions, I can't think of many at all. I mean, John, can you identify some?
Well, no, I can't. I must say proudly, in a way, that Fudd and Toots were forces in jazz in the 20s and from Charleston. There was some cross-pollination with musicians from the Jenkins Orphanage, and I think that was part of their formation. But also, they were definitely in the school of the white jazz, big bands, and dance music as it evolved in the 20s. And remember that back then there weren't CDs and high-quality playback equipment. So dance bands and live music was the prevalent entertainment of the 20s and 30s. And in fact, back when the population of our country then was only about 100 million people, there were 250,000 professional musicians in the United States of America. I mean, being a musician was, I believe, much more prevalent than it is in America today. And maybe that was, again, just a function of our great technology and playback of music today. But live music was great. And the thing about jazz development was that orchestrated jazz, arranged jazz, was in its infancy. And Fudd was one of 10 or so arrangers of the 20s and early 30s who really developed what our ears know as the big band sound. And that came out of that white jazz arranged tradition as opposed to some of the African-American bands. But I must say this, and it's not just a nephew speaking, because Gunther Schuller, in his book Early Jazz, compared the arrangements of my uncle, of Fudd Livingston, to the early works of Duke Ellington, and that in some cases that his ingenuity, that his musical genius at writing and arranging even surpassed, at that time in the 20s, the work that the Duke was doing. And that's a mouthful, I know, but it didn't come from me. It came from Gunther Schuller.
Well, what you were saying about live music, if you went to any southern town with two or three large hotels, the hotels had their own orchestras.
Not only that, but radio stations had their own orchestras, bands.
So and all those bigger bands, when you got over six or eight players, you needed arrangements to keep everybody in order. And so Fudd was working like crazy in the even during the Depression, working for the biggest band in the country, the Paul Whiteman Band, starting in 1930 to 33, and then working for Kraft Music Hall for the radio show and other radio shows. So then he moved out to Hollywood in the mid-30s and worked with the Jimmy Dorsey Band, doing arrangements for film and for Bing Crosby for his radio programs. So he was busy as can be, and I know he had a very active social life as well.
Is that where he began his, you know, Hollywood high life led him astray?
I think a propensity to drinking was prevalent among jazz musicians from the very start. And the story that Ben told about Fudd missing the gig over in London was the beginning of that practical problem he had with his alcoholism and being reliable. It didn't stop him for another 10 years of being creative and having some great works and recording sessions. And in fact, in 1931, wrote his most memorable song, I'm Through With Love. And I told you the story earlier about how Hannah Williams ended up marrying Jack Dempsey, and he was heartbroken. And I believe that experience is what led to that amazing song, I'm Through With Love.
John, you said earlier that your uncle was exposed to the Jenkins Orphanage Band performing near where the family lived. People may have heard of the band, but I think we might want to talk about that particular group in more detail.
Fortunately, about 10 minutes of film exists of the Jenkins Orphanage Band, I think, from 1928. It is, I think, the only or one of the only examples of their actual music that we have. Primarily, the band has evolved into the area of mythology. Everyone talks about it, and rightly so, because it is so important. But when you get right down to what it actually did, that evidence has been rare. Now we have it. It is housed in the film archive of the University of South Carolina and is available online, I think through YouTube.com. So there is evidence there. There's a knee-jerk reaction, I think, that indicates that the band played jazz. Now, one needs to define what one means by jazz, but in this 10-minute clip, what I would call it is a kind of semi-improvised music based on marches, that the marching band tradition was in back of it, at least to one degree or another. There is some syncopation, but I don't know what definition of jazz that would embrace. So, I mean, we could talk about the Jenkins Orphanage all time, and the Reverend Daniel Jenkins, who set that up, I think, in the 1890s, was, in my estimation, a great man. I mean, he looked around and he saw these black children who were homeless on the streets, these waifs, and decided to do something about it. Not only did he do something about it, but he gave them a trade. I mean, most, if not all of them, studied music. They could play instruments. And you know what? They were pretty good, as evidenced by this 10-minute film excerpt that we have.
So Reverend Jenkins founded this incredible orphanage. There was a need there in Charleston, and he began to instill the training and love of music. And the band, as Ben mentioned, was incredible. And it was, in a way, the first sustainable nonprofit of Charleston, because the kids would earn money that would support the orphanage. But this is what happened. When the 19-teens and 20s rolled around and big bands were forming, many of the former orphans from Jenkins Orphanage left Charleston to populate the Duke Ellington Band, the Count Basie Band. In fact, Cat Anderson was an early high note trumpet specialist with Duke Ellington for many years from Jenkins Orphanage. Freddie Green, who played rhythm guitar, was the mainstay of the rhythm section for the Count Basie Band for over 40 years, came from Jenkins Orphanage. Jabbo Smith, who was a renowned jazz trumpet player in the 20s, was really a rival of Louis Armstrong, came from Jenkins Orphanage in Charleston. So there were all these early jazz players and leaders that came from Charleston, and that's why I say our jazz heritage is just as rich as New Orleans and Chicago and these other cities.
That's an incredible story, and Charleston Rider is part of the Renaissance picked that up because DuBose Hayward in Mamba's Daughters talks about the protagonist, a young African-American woman who goes to New York, to Harlem, to seek her fame and fortune successfully.
Not only that, but he also, we all know Porgy and Bess, which is described as often as an opera, but he wrote the lyrics to a lot of the tunes for that production. And he alone, he collaborated with Ira Gershwin on most of them, but one that he did by himself was Summertime, which is one of the most recorded tunes ever. And there was another composer, a white composer, who came out of Charleston. That's Arthur Freed, who is best known as a movie producer. He won Academy Awards for American in Paris and Gigi. But he started out as a song plugger, and he wrote all kinds of good tunes, including Singing in the Rain, I Cried for You, This Heart of Mine, You Were Meant for Me, and many others. But he was born right there in Charleston.
So the confluence of movies and Gershwin does cross Uncle Fudd's path as well. So Uncle Fudd was in Hollywood, as I mentioned, during the mid-30s, and an augmented version of the Jimmy Dorsey band that Fudd was playing with did the soundtrack for Shall We Dance, which was a Ginger Rogers, Fred Astaire movie. And it was all Gershwin music, and Gershwin did the arrangements as well. And Nat Shilkret was the producer, the music producer on the set. And he wasn't happy, believe it or not, with Gershwin's arrangements. So he pulled Fudd out of the band and asked him to work on Gershwin's arrangements, which apparently really irritated George Gershwin to no end. But the result turned out to be quite good. The songs were a little more swinging when Fudd got through with them.
Talk about connections, though. I mean, we talked about Paul Whiteman earlier. It was Whiteman who commissioned Gershwin's Rhapsody in Blue in 1925.
Absolutely.
So when you talk about arranging, you're both musicians. Explain that to those of us who are not. When you talk about arranging, what is one doing?
Well, you're the mastermind for the sound, the combined sound of all the instruments. The more instruments you have and the more variety of instruments you have, the more difficult and complicated it can be because you have to be familiar with what range a particular instrument has and what key it's written in. And so you're writing a separate melody line for the flute, the clarinet, the alto sax, the tenor sax, each different trombone, each different trumpet, the rhythm section, and then it all comes together on one sheet of music for the conductor or band leader to lead. So with arranged music, same with symphonic. What your ear really hears and enjoys at the end of the day is that combined sound, that arranged sound. And that's why I continue to believe that Fudd's real contribution to modern music and to jazz music was, in fact, in his incredible arranging ability, and which, as I said, led to the what we now know as the big band sound.
Okay.
Humpty Dumpty is an amazing sound. It's a small group, but it's originally written by Fudd and arranged by him and played, interestingly, by a cornetist of the 20s who is quite renowned named Bix Beiderbecke.
All right, that wonderful instrumental, I'm Through With Love, has lyrics. Were most of his compositions just instrumental, or did they have lyrics?
Well, both. Fudd was not a lyricist, so when he would write a song that included lyrics, he would involve. And some of his later music was done with a Charlestonian, Bobby Cathcart, wrote the lyrics to some of Fudd's music, like Springtime in Charleston they collaborated on. But Fudd's arranging and composing was all the music and not lyrics. He'd always add a lyricist.
Okay. A couple of things, though, about that Humpty Dumpty. If you listen to the initial piano interlude by Frank Signorelli, he plays a few notes in there that are picked up in 1947 by Dodo Marmarosa in Charlie Parker's recording of Relaxin' at Camarillo, Take C. So there's an influence there, however direct, nonetheless, there is an influence there on Dodo Marmarosa with Charlie Parker. I might also mention that Adrian Rollini was playing the bass sax on that, which was also the case in the Nobody's Sweetheart that we heard earlier. And as John mentioned, the cornet player is Bix Beiderbecke. And if we're talking about alcoholics, Bix Beiderbecke made this great, great impact, yet died young.
And if you heard that violin solo, that was the father of jazz violinist Joe Venuti. And what a practical joker he was. All these guys, by the way, were a riot. I mean, they were always playing jokes on each other, and they just, they lived the life of Riley. They had a ball.
What about Springtime in Charleston? Is that a romantic piece?
The backstory of Springtime in Charleston was there was a song contest with the Azalea Festival in 1946 or 47, and this was during Fudd's later years, and he was trying to get a buck wherever he could, and so he wrote a song and entered it in the contest, and Bobby Cathcart wrote the lyrics, as I mentioned, and they won the prize, which was $1,500, which was a lot of money back then.
Hey, yes.
But of course, by the next morning, the money was gone, but they had a great party that night in the local bar down in Charleston.
All right. Let's go back to Paul Whiteman, one of the great band leaders of the 20s. How did he and Fudd get along? Rivalry or?
Well, Paul hired Fudd in the late 20s, or either it was 1930, and Fudd stayed with Whiteman for a few years. I think it was just because of his ability to arrange that Whiteman wanted him in the band. I'll be honest with you, one part of my research I haven't completed is to go to Williams College in Massachusetts, where Paul Whiteman, when he ended his career, gave all his papers and all to Williams College. They have a collection there. And they tell me they have a total of 73 complete Fudd Livingston arrangements as part of the Paul Whiteman Library there. I need to go see him.
Paul Whiteman was known as the king of jazz, which strikes me as preposterous. But you listen to that music, and it's pretty bland, I think you'd say. There are some soloists in it, like Bix, for example, like Fudd, for example. But if there was a king of jazz in those days, already it was Duke Ellington, not Paul Whiteman.
Absolutely. But also importantly, it's where Bing Crosby and the Rhythm Boys, as they were called, there were a trio of guys singing together, and that's where Bing Crosby got his start, was with the Paul Whiteman Band.
John, you've got this cache up at Williams College. Is your goal, or are you going to try to get things copied? I mean, obviously you're collecting everything you can about your Uncle Fudd.
Well, I try wherever I can. I must tell you that copyright laws are very stringent, or people adhere to them more or afraid of breaking them. So libraries are very careful about letting you copy things anymore. In fact, I had to prove to the New York City Library and to Lincoln Center Library that my family actually still held some of the copyrights to some of these songs before they would let me copy some original arrangements that both of those libraries had of Uncle Fudd's, of both Imagination and Humpty Dumpty. In Fudd's own handwriting from 1927, I found his original arrangements, and I shared them with a band in New York that plays early 20s and 30s style music. And when I visit that band in New York, they play those arrangements for us.
So how do you plan to dispose of your collection ultimately? Where would that go?
I've talked with the folks at the College of Charleston about taking them when the time is right, and having a collection there at the College of Charleston.
Sounds like this is something that really ought to be Piccolo Spoleto. Or did you do a presentation at Spoleto a while back?
Last year I did a presentation at Spoleto where we did a conversation and also shared some of the music of Uncle Fudd. So we've actually made the big festival, the Spoleto Festival, which is coming up, of course, in Charleston in just a few weeks. So I invite everybody to come down to Charleston. We have Piccolo Spoleto with 500 different events, an amazing lineup for Spoleto Festival USA this year. So come to Charleston and enjoy some of the music and other culture. It's a great time to be in Charleston.
Well, I've heard you on the piano. you play any other instruments?
I used to play saxophone myself, but it's been a few years. It's been a few years.
And Ben, I've never inquired about your musical talent.
I have none. I am often asked if I play, and my answer is yes, records.
So, I would like to share another song of Fudd's, which he wrote and arranged, a small band setting. It was recorded by a number of different bands called Feeling No Pain. It was written in 1927, really at the height of some of his writing. And this song is a little more in the Dixieland early jazz style, and it's so much fun, and it's so indicative of the time. As I mentioned, the musicians, they love to party and have a good time, and I do believe that's where the name of the song comes from, Feeling No Pain.
Obviously, you think of the movies of the 20s and 30s, and I'm just trying to think undergraduates at Carolina or the College of Charleston trying to dance to this music.
By the way, I couldn't recall the name a minute ago. The band in New York is Vince Giordano and the Nighthawks, and I recommend them to anyone visiting New York. They play up there regularly, and they did the soundtrack for some shows on Netflix, I think. Boardwalk, was that the name of the show? But anyway, Vince Giordano, he's an amazing musician, and he's an arranger, and he loves this era of music and does a great job with it.
But Walter, you mentioned dancing to that music. How did the Charleston dance get to New York? We've talked about James P. Johnson as being the composer of the tune, the Charleston, James P. Johnson, the great jazz pianist. But credit is usually given to a man from Charleston named Charleston Brown, that he used to do a Geechee dance, as they called it, on the streets of Charleston. He ended up in New York and did that dance on the corners, and it was picked up and became a craze. Can that be documented? I've tried my best to do that. There is some evidence for that. But Charleston Brown is the one who is typically credited for introducing the dance, the Charleston, to New York and therefore to the country.
And so James Free Johnson was actually a Tin Pan Alley Broadway writer, composer. He was not from Charleston, and he must have been exposed to this dance as it came to New York and ended up writing the song, the Charleston, to go into one of the Broadway plays that he was writing. Interestingly enough, I do have, documentation that James P. Johnson, although he might never have come to Charleston, was in London with Reverend Jenkins' son, who was also a composer and musician, and they knew each other. So there was that Charleston connection there with Mr. Johnson.
We spent a good bit of time talking about Fudd's early career, but what about his later career, John, Ben?
Well, he continued to write and compose and mostly popular songs, but he did arrangements for the Tommy Dorsey Band in the late 40s, and even Stan Kenton picked up one of his songs called Never Too Late to Pray with a very modern arrangement. Tommy Dorsey's band recorded it as well. As an instrumentalist, he pretty much gave up blowing on the saxophone and just played piano during the latter years of his life and would supplement selling and writing songs and arrangements with, frankly, just playing in piano bars and playing solo piano. But there was a lot of alcohol in the latter part of his life, and it impacted his ability. So he and to let you know, Fudd really tried to quit drinking. I mean, he just really was never able to, and the family tried to support him. And one time, my granddad took him up to Richmond, Virginia, to one of these facilities or institutions where they try to help you dry out. So how do you get Uncle Fudd to go to a place like that? Well, you have a few drinks, right, and get him on the train and take him up there. And so by the time they get up to Richmond, well, my granddad and Uncle Fudd, they were, both on a bender. And so my granddad is paying for the cab, right, there in front of the institution. Fudd runs on up there, and he says, now, when this guy comes in, he's going to try to tell you that he's bringing me here, but you can obviously tell that he's the one that's loaded. And so when my granddad got up there, they grabbed him and put him in the institution, and it took a whole 12 hours and phone calls and messages to get the tables turned. And, of course, where did they find Fudd?
In the bar.
In the nearest bar.
All right, so he was back in Charleston at this time?
He would come in and out of Charleston. He was really a bit of a nomad, I think, the last 8 or 10 years of his life. He was spent some time in San Francisco, New Orleans. I went to New Orleans a few years ago, and I ran into some old musicians who knew Uncle Fudd. He was there in the early 50s for a while, just playing the nightlife down there. And so he was a bit itinerant. But whenever he would need a break or try to dry out or get a little family support, sometimes meaning money, he would come back through Charleston.
Do you know what happened to Toots? Because his recording career, anyway, was limited entirely to Ted Weems. Did he have other affiliations, and what happened to him?
There were just a few, because like Bix Beiderbecke, my Uncle Toots died in 1931, I'm told, of a drug overdose. And again, this is why I think my family did not, number one, encourage me to be a musician, and didn't talk about it a whole lot because of Toots dying from a drug overdose in 1931 and Fudd's eventual alcoholism. But that shouldn't get in the way of the genius and the career that they had, even though it might have just been a 20-year, 25-year period. That I've uncovered. It's really, truly genius and a real contribution to American music.
Well, I think our listeners out there are finding out Charleston's role in American jazz, which has really been an untold story. Ben, any last comments you would like to make?
No, other than you're exactly right about that. Charleston has been phenomenal, and again, primarily, aside from the Livingstons, because of the Jenkins Orphanage bands.
John Manawa, thank you for being on the Journal today. As we go out, we'll have the mayor of Charleston playing the Charleston.
Well, thank you, Walter. It's been so great to be with you, and I must admit I'm probably the only mayor of Charleston who can play the Charleston. Here goes.
And thank you, Walter and John.
This is Walter Edgar, and I hope you enjoyed today's journal. It was especially nice to learn about the role of Charleston in the development of the country's jazz scene. Musicians, black and white, who grew up in Charleston, learned their craft or their art there, and then went off somewhere else. In Fred Livingston's case, he followed his older brother Toots to Chicago, and then to the greater jazz world, whether it was L.A. or New York. He played and arranged with all of the big bands in the decades between World War I and World War II. This is Walter Edgar. Join me next week for more of The Journal.
The views and opinions expressed on Walter Edgar's Journal are not necessarily those of South Carolina Public Radio.